This is Trainer Talk on HRRN Live.
But it was all for Shug McGee.
Super Saver wins the Derby for Top Pletcher.
The Salt will give trainer Steve Asmussen career win number 6,000.
It was all have another for Doug O'Neill.
Oxbow and D-Wayne Lucas. Trainer D-Wayne Lucas, a sixth win.
And Al's Rosie is going to give trainer Gary Contessa his 2,000th career win.
And dialed in, never got to them. It was Animal Kingdom for Graham Motion.
Steve Hobby with career victory number 1,000 at Oaklawn.
The show that trainers listen to. Now, here's Mike Penna and Jude Feld.
Good afternoon once again, everyone, and welcome to Trainer Talk presented by Fasic Tipton. This is indeed the show that trainers listen to, and we do welcome everybody just tuning in coast to coast across North America on Sirius Channel 93. And for those of you who have been with us for the past 3 hours with Chad Summers, Sean Feld, and Ellis Starr listening to that coverage of Saratoga and Del Mar, we do welcome you back, all of those tuning in on XM 209 and everybody tuning in around the world on our website, horseracingradio.net. Mike Penna, Baron of the Backstretch, Jude Feld, the Pontiff of the Pick Four, our producer Lee Della Pina. We are with you again for this very special Trainer Talk show. And Jude, tonight, all about girl power here on Trainer Talk, as a pair of female trainers will join us. Michelle Nihe will be with us in the first half of the program, and then we'll visit with Josie Carroll in the second half of the show.
Yeah, really looking forward to it. Both great gals, and happy to have them on board tonight.
Yeah, and you know, you and I had an opportunity to catch up with trainer Jeff Greenhill on this very same program a couple of months ago. And you remember Jeff left a career as a prominent chemical engineer to become a horse trainer. And a lot of people thought he was off his rocker when they heard that story. Michelle Nihe has a story that may top Jeff's story.
Let's hear it.
Well, she is with us now, and much like our second guest, Josie Carroll, both of them hailing from the great confines of Canada. Michelle, born in Calgary, Alberta, Canada. She graduated from the University of Saskatchewan, I can actually say that, with a master's degree, and then received a PhD in neuroscience from the University of Kentucky. She took out her trainer's license in December of 2007, and since that time has tallied 57 winners and nearly $2.8 million in progeny earnings, or purse earnings, I should say, and she is in the midst of her best year to date. Michelle, welcome to Trainer Talk.
Thank you very much for having me.
Now, I mentioned this story with Jeff Greenhill, leaving that job as a prominent chemical engineer to become a trainer. I just read your bio. University of Saskatchewan. I'm going to get that right at some point during the interview. A master's degree from there, a PhD in neuroscience from the University of Kentucky, but you decided, you know what? I want to train horses instead. Pretty wild.
Well, yeah, you'd certainly look at it that way. It's probably even worse than that, because I spent 4 years after UK, I went to Johns Hopkins in Baltimore and was on junior faculty there for that period of time. So I actually managed to get to an echelon of science and research and medicine that I aspired to for most of my academic career, and then threw that away. So it's just one step worse.
Well, I don't know how you did all that, because you don't look like you're that old. That's a lot of years to spend, getting to be a doctor. And geez, Louise, you're very, very well preserved.
It's the cryogenic freezing in Canada. Georgie works as well.
Did you have people come up to you or say things to you when you said, hey, I'm going to leave Johns Hopkins, I'm going to go back to the track and start galloping horses? Because you basically started at the very bottom rung and worked your way back up again at the racetrack. Were there people that looked at you and said, Michelle, you're out of your mind?
Oh, yeah. Just about every trainer I ever worked for, including Todd. And justifiably, it's an incredibly challenging industry, very demanding in terms of commitment and time. And you know, it doesn't always translate, you know, hard work and perseverance. You, in just about every other occupation in the world, ensures you of success, and that is not so in this industry.
Yeah, that is so true. I mean, I always say if trainers spent as much time working at McDonald's as they do training horses, they'd be gazillionaires. And that's so true. And a lot of it's based on luck. I mean, being in the right place at the right time, and you can get up every morning, you can do your work, you can really be a good horseman, the whole nine yards, and there's no guarantee that you're even going to hit the winner's circle.
So true. It's absolutely the truth. And you can have a lot of things going your way, nice horses, great owners, and still, you know, just some little thing goes wrong at the wrong moment, the wrong time, and you're out of the loop on, you know, on taking off track of where you really needed to be or wanted to be for something good to happen. And it's just, yeah, there's so many ways to lose a race. Only one way to win it.
You know, Michelle, I can imagine it had to take an awful lot of courage on your part to make that move and give up everything you had worked so hard for throughout most of your life and now jump into a brand new career. That had to take a huge leap of faith and just a ton of courage.
I guess somebody told me after I got to the track that if you're going to be stupid, you better be strong. So I think it has a lot to do with inner strength and a little bit of inner stupidity, but It was certainly a leap of faith at some level. I spent an inordinate time second-guessing myself after leaving Hopkins and really thinking about it, because I hadn't really made the decision to make a career out of it for a few months. But I think ultimately what transpired in my own decision-making process was that I recognized the two things, that happiness was a big player in what had to happen for me for the rest of my life. And, you know, when you recognize accomplishment doesn't always mean you're happy with who you are, what you've done. It becomes more important to be happy. And the second thing is that I think in when you're undertaking something that requires a great deal of energy, you know, even if I wasn't riding horses every day, you still have to feel as though if you're going to do this, you better do it now. Because if you wait a lot longer, you wait till you retire, you probably aren't going to, you know, have the same resources to call upon. So two things really mandated the decision for me.
Did you actually have a passion for what you were doing before? I mean, obviously you devoted a large block of your life and time and effort to that. Did you have a passion for that and racing was just more, or how did all that work?
I literally grew up as one of those kids, boys or girls, you know, that stay awake at night with a flashlight under the covers reading newspaper stories about Secretariat and Ruffian. And, you know, there were books and old newscasts on television, and that, you know, we had so much more televised racing at the time. And those things were, to me, the most moving, the most sort of penultimate parts of my day, of my life. And you know, I remember being in grade school and elementary just doing nothing but writing stories and drawing pictures and reading more material and trying to find ways to climb on something that looked like a horse. If it was a llama, I was riding it.
Did you spend much time around the racetrack as a young girl like that?
You know, I was never in a position to be able to do that, but I rode all my life. I rode. My father was kind enough to put me up on a Shetland pony before I could talk or walk, because I had indicated somehow that that was what I wanted to do. And he would spend time walking me around hillsides in Alberta, just hanging out with me on this pony. And we moved to San Francisco, and he allowed me to continue riding when we went to the States. And we came back to Canada, and I was, you know, every second, every moment of every day, I was involved somehow, cleaning stalls and picking out feed and riding somebody else's horse so I could, you know, have a chance to ride another horse. And it was a driving passion. I think a lot of kids, you know, end up sort of losing that drive somewhere in high school because boys become a bigger part of their life. And I was so committed to it. I said, I don't care about anything else. All I want to do is horses. So as long as my grades were up, which was always easy for me, as long as everything else became something that was a reward, it was my choice was always to spend as much time as I could on a horse.
Was your father in the medical field, or did you like follow in the family footsteps that way?
You know, we've traced my genealogy as far back as I can find on both sides of that tree, and we can't find a horseman anywhere. My father was fresh off the boat from Japan. He was a biochemist who was a frustrated physicist, you know, basically more or less the same kind of career issues, but he was a diehard scientist. And actually, I didn't know until later on in life that he was doing a lot of work in areas of neuroscience, because he'd actually passed away when I was a teenager. My mother was a lawyer and also had zero aspirations of ever having anything to do with horses. So we really were at a loss to find, you know, even generations back where I could have come up with this strange gene, but we've never traced it down.
Well, it's amazing that it sounds like, Michelle, even when you were achieving your master's degree at Saskatchewan, and you couldn't have just gone to Harvard, so it'd be easier for me to pronounce, and then picking up the PhD in neuroscience at the University of Kentucky, this was something that was still pulling you in so many different directions and trying to take you back to horses. How were you able to balance the studies and the amount of time you had to put in on the academic side with your love of horses as you were going through your schooling?
I was very fortunate to be blessed, and probably, you know, I spent a lot of time with my father in labs when I was very young. So, you know, my mother was a stalwart at education. A lot of her own education came at a time when I was a child. So she was going to law school when I was, I think, 4 or 5 years old. So my English and grammar were constantly being corrected. My father was always dragging me around to labs. And so academics were very, very easy for me. I didn't really ever have any real difficulty learning or taking tests or going to school. So I had the energy and the time to put in pretty much anywhere I wanted to. And so I was fortunate also to be a reasonably good athlete, and that not just translated into track and field and volleyball, but I rode a lot. And when you do something that you know you're good at, it's easy to practice. It's easy to keep the interest alive on many different venues. So the more I was able to expose myself to, the more, you know, you don't want to put all the weight of your success in one area, but talent is only half of the game, and, you know, being able to be devoted to something is the other half. And when I went to university, it was much the same. I just was able to change the focus of, you know, what kind of riding I did and who I was studying under. So going from, you know, rodeo riding and barrel racing and taking a few jumpers out to being able to, you know, study under some really great dressage riders and a couple of event riders, I was kind of spreading my exposure around a lot. And I had the very great benefit of having teachers who were schooled in Europe and around the country. So none of those things ultimately matter a lot when it comes to racing per se, but what it does do is it teaches you a lot about the fact that horses are truly more or less all the same. You know, they're built very much alike. And if you start to develop an understanding and a knowledge of how horses generate strength and how they become better at what you're asking them to do, it becomes a little bit more straightforward about how to understand how to develop a horse, how to bring them along, the difference between young horses, old horses, and the way that some of the psychology of fear happens, because horses aren't predators, so they tend not to be automatically courageous. Courage and confidence is sometimes something that's built into all of us, but it's also learned, and that takes a big leap of faith to understand how to bring a horse into a situation where there's golf carts and gates and people on rails, and teach them how to be confident in that scenario as opposed to out in the field running around other horses.
Michelle Niehe joining us on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
So where's the missing link, Michelle? Where did you switch over to the dark side?
That reminds me of it, of something I just heard the other day. It was a T-shirt that said, "Come to the dark side. We have cookies." I don't know the answer to that. I think that I potentially was always enamored by what I saw as something that was probably the most incredible example of athleticism and teamwork in a horse and a rider. And I think that even though I'd always admired the Olympians and the sport horses, there's something about racing that was just on the edge of being something that we attribute to a man-made environment, but yet we're still capitalizing on what horses really and truly want to do and how they act sort of out on their own in the wild and in their normal environment. They're competitive. They run because that's, you know, how they're built. And when you're around a racehorse and you can sort of feel that huge amount of desire and you almost regard for one another. When you have a really talented horse, they enjoy training. They drag you to the racetrack every morning. They want to go train. It's not really different for a lot of other horses that like to do what they're doing. But when you find racehorses that love their job, it's something that fills you and what you do every day, and it makes you feel like this is something you just want to do every day because it's passionate, it's fulfilling. There's something more than just you that pulls you into that 3:30 in the morning alarm.
So what year was it that you finally decided to make the move, go back to the racetrack or go to the racetrack, and who were some of the people that helped you get started?
You know, that really happened in 2001. In the earlier, I left Hopkins in the early part of that year. I went back to Kentucky. I was galloping polo ponies and working on some retired racehorses to become show horses. And a friend of mine who was riding at the racetrack at Keeneland said, you know, why don't you think about coming and riding in the morning since you're up all the time anyway? And I sort of, you know, I thought, well, I can't do that. I don't know anything about riding on the racetrack. So a friend of mine took me up into the grandstand one morning, drew me a map, told me what the poles meant and how many of them were, which is a little tricky at Keeneland because it's a mile and a 16th. And there's two wires, so, you know, I had to remember that if they told you to back up to the wire, you had to clarify which wire you were backing up to. And I showed up, and I remember thinking, I wonder what happens if it doesn't quite go as planned, which obviously happened a few times since that point. But there was a moment in that first day that I remember thinking, this is really what I want to do. This is absolutely and completely where I think I belong and what I want to do. So since that time, a lot of my imagery of why I'm here and what that took, it has changed a lot. But I think that the reinforcement has always come for me from being on horses and knowing that I know how to make them more comfortable. I know how to make them better. I know how to develop young horses. I know how to accomplish all these things successfully enough to be able to stand back and look at a horse who's, you know, 5 or 6 years old that I've been around for 4 years and think, boy, he looks good. And he's doing, you know, really well. And I couldn't be more proud of him or happier of his accomplishment. Well, so I don't know what the bridge was, but I know that there was a moment in 2001 when I recognized that I was happier doing that than I was doing anything else that I'd done before.
Well, you look back in your bio and you see names like Andrew McKeever and Dallas Stewart, Christopher Speckert, and Becky Maker, and then you also see trainer Todd Pletcher, who I know those years working with Todd were very special for you. You had a quote that I had read that said that, "I think Todd, for better or worse, is the main reason why I am a trainer now. Working for and learning from Todd is like going to Johns Hopkins." That's high praise, Michelle.
Well, it's, you know, it's true. I mean, it's very difficult to not look at his accomplishments and continued success and not know that he's an amazing man. He's an amazing mentor, and his being exposed to that organization is, notwithstanding, probably the best thing that could have happened if this is the route that I wanted to go. But being exposed to that many good horses and so many in a short period of time, you know, he's at any one time there's probably somewhere between 250 and 300 horses somewhere in the works. So, you know, that it's, I remember feeling when I got to Hopkins like there was just so much to learn and so much to do and so many opportunities, and I just needed to cram it all in. And, you know, I remember feeling exactly the same way when I was working for Todd. It was, you know, just almost overwhelming but exciting. And, you know, as long as you felt like you could stay awake long enough every day to get as much as you could in, that you might get most of it.
Would you speak a little bit about Todd's horsemanship? A lot of times people say, you know, oh, he's got so many horses, he does it with numbers and this and that. But would you be willing to talk about Todd's horsemanship a little bit and how it's influenced you?
Absolutely. I don't think I could give away any secrets because he's very taciturn. He doesn't, you know, I can ask him a question and he'll tell me, but he's not garrulous. You know, you don't go out there and hear him just start to talk to you about everything that he's seeing or doing. So you have to pay attention and watch horses yourself and understand why decisions are made the way they're made. But he's very intuitive. He's obviously, you know, he hails from a great family of horsemen and horsemanship himself between his own father, JJ, and then, of course, being with Wayne for so many years. So a lot of what he does is are developments of his own style. And I did ask him that, too. I said, you know, of the things that you think you've taken away from all of these people you've been exposed to whom do you look towards the most? And he said, you know, probably the one thing in the main area that I've learned the most in is the organization issues from Jeff Lucas. He said, Jeff really taught me, you know, the issues of how to stay this organized in a big barn. And, you know, I'm a fraction of the size of Todd, but I recognized a long time ago that it doesn't really matter how big or small you are. If you use a good system that you can stay on top of, organization is everything. And that's one of his key assets. He knows exactly where all the horses are, you know, when they were shod, who got vaccinated, what they did galloping that day, because he has an exceptionally good system. And I obviously took that with me, and I'm assuming George and Michael Dilger did the same, because, you know, I'll recognize that we all have very similar even charts, because it works. And Todd's, you know, made all of that work for him.
Trainer Michelle Nehe, our special guest on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Josie Carroll coming up in the second half of the program, so stay tuned for that. Michelle, you talked about everything that you accomplished in your chosen field originally, and you kind of reached the top of the mountain working with Johns Hopkins in that respect. And then you go to work as an exercise rider, you work your way up, you work with Todd, and then in 2007, you make the decision to go out on your own. Was there a sense at that point that, hey, I've now achieved the mountaintop in this new profession, or was there still work left to do?
Oh, yeah, this industry never lets you get all the way to the top, really, unless you're Todd Pletcher. There's so much more that I really would love to be able to accomplish. But I think that what's important, one of the things that I've recognized is incredibly important is how to see yourself through a different set of internal glasses. If you look for success every day and you know, want to measure yourself against the top of the field, you'll be disappointed. So I think you have to be, at least the way that I perceive this is, first of all, recognizing that, you know, this was a big jump for me. I don't have a lot of pedigree or background. I don't have, you know, a lot of reliance behind which I would be able to fall back on. So being able to arrive at this spot this quickly is something that I'm very proud of, but I'm also aware that it's a function of how, with, you know, I've been able to put a great team together. I've had some excellent support from the guys that work for me, and I had the benefit of having some absolutely wonderful owners who've been behind me since the inception and continue to support me, and new owners who are exceptional and have great horses. So, you know, the success that you have to remind yourself of every day are, you know, I look at everything as though I'm climbing a mountain, and sometimes reaching the top of that is not really ultimately the success that you're looking for. It isn't really the goal, it's the journey. And in this business, every positive forward step, even the win that we had on Monday, is hugely successful for us.
Well, Michelle, when I called you and asked you to appear on this program, and I told you it was going to be about 25 minutes for the interview, and you said to me, I don't know if I can fill the time the way that Nick Zito filled the time last week. And guess what? You can hold your own with Nick Zito or anybody else in this business. So we want to thank you. Believe it or not, we didn't even get to some of your career highlights, including Prince Will I Am. So you'll have to promise to come back on and join us again up the road, and we'll kind of have Michelle Nihe part two.
It's very kind of you. It's been delightful, and I appreciate the time.
Well, you're very impressive, and you need more clients. So anybody out there that needs a trainer, send Michelle a horse.
Michelle, thanks so much, and we certainly appreciate
thanks.
All right, Michelle Nihe, our special guest here on Trainer Talk. Jude, we could have spent another hour with Michelle.
Yeah,
so
we just may have to change the format of these shows.
We need to go an hour
you
with
know?
Everybody.
And the trainers always put you off and say, I can't talk about myself. But, I mean, literally, I mean, I could have sat there for three more hours. I mean, I'd like to just sit down with her at lunch and just shoot the breeze.
Amazing.
What a brilliant person.
Amazing. And the second half promises to be equally as impressive. Josie Carroll, the native of Toronto, Canada, coming up next on Trainer Talk. Presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. EPO Equine, the all-natural, healthy, safe, and legal blood builder, would like to extend a special congratulations to Nick and Martha Gonzalez and the entire team of this year's Queen's Plate winner, Midnight Aria, as well as Tony Alanya and all the connections of the remarkable Captain Treacherous, winner of the Metro and Meadowlands Pace. To learn more about how EPO Equine can help your equine athlete reach its true potential, contact Joe Valente at 215-501-6880 or visit EPOEquine.com.
Fasig Tipton welcomes nominations now for the November sale, the highest average and median of any mixed sale in the world. 15 horses in 2012 sold for $1 million and higher, more than any other mixed sale in the world. Exceptional weanling market, with foals selling for up to $620,000. Horse of the Year Hover de Grace sold for $10 million, the world's highest priced auction thoroughbred of 2012. The November sale at Fasig Tipton in Kentucky. Nominate now.
Summer is here, and no doubt the farm needs a little sprucing up. When it's time to paint the fences and barns, think farmpaint.com. At farmpaint.com, you get the industry's best coatings and paints, factory direct, at low, low prices. Farmpaint.com is your source for quality paints, roof coatings, dustless arena footings, and more. You can purchase online or drop into a farm paint store near you. Buy factory direct and save at farmpaint.com. That's farmpaint.com.
I'm here with Dr. Jim Chiappetta from Flair, maker of Flair Equine Nasal Strips. Jim, how do Flair strips, when applied to a horse's nose, help protect their lungs?
Mike, studies show that 90% of the resistance to airflow in exercising horses is in the upper airway, with the majority of that being in the nose. When exercising at high intensity, many horses can bleed into their lungs. The strip's been shown to reduce that bleeding by reducing the resistance to airflow through the nasal passages. This keeps horses healthy by keeping their lungs healthier during performance and training.
To learn more, visit flarestrips.com.
RaceWorksReport.com.
What is it?
What is it?
What is it?
What is it, baby?
International racing, weekend stakes recaps, always free selections, great stories, workout information, racing news, handicapping tips, spot plays, and more.
It's as marvelous and as simple as that.
Join thousands of other thoroughbred racing fans by going to RaceWorksReport.com. Make RaceWorksReport.com your number one source for thoroughbred racing information.
That's great.
RaceWorksReport.com.
The Arlington Million.
Dom Boosie, the European Raider, to get it, beat Gio Ponti, and a million shocker. But it is Kay Blanco's million. Kay Blanco has won it from Gio Ponti. Little Mike close to the finish. Osiris closing, but time's up. Little Mike made every yard a winning one.
The Arlington Million. Saturday on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Go to horseracingradio.net for more information. This is Trainer Talk on HRRN Live, presented by Phasic Tipton.
Mike Penna, Jude Feld, back with you on Trainer Talk, presented by Phasic Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. An enjoyable visit with Michelle Nihe in the first half of the program, and now looking forward to another native of Canada, going to Toronto, Canada, for our next guest. It is trainer Josie Carroll on a Trainer Talk edition that is all about girl power here tonight on HRRN. Josie Carroll amassing 608 career winners in a tremendous career thus far. She has more than $32 million in purse earnings to her credit, at least her horses do, and she is nice enough to be with us here on Trainer Talk tonight. Josie, thanks so much for taking the time. Josie, are you there?
Oh, hi. Yes, thank you.
That was your cue.
Okay. Well, I can hardly hear you.
Oh, no. Thanks for taking the time. Is that a little bit better?
That's better.
Oh, great. Great. Well, happy to have you on board here tonight and looking forward to hearing your story. As we talked about when I called you and asked you to come on the show, this is much more about Josie Carroll and your career as opposed to, you know, the horses that you have in training now. And it's interesting, when I was looking through some of your bio information and reading back through your story, you didn't take a traditional path to becoming a horse trainer because you didn't grow up in a racing family and you were never really around the track as a child. Talk about that.
No, I wasn't, not at all. But from the time I can remember, I had a fascination with racing. You know, our sport used to get a lot of coverage in the newspaper, and every weekend I'd cut out pictures of the stake-winning racehorses. And, you know, started just looking at racing, and I actually, in my scrapbook, have pages and pages and pages of my daily gambles from the time I was about 7 or 8, you know, just picking horses' names. And then you'd sort of find a pattern, you get to find horses you'd like, and you'd look for their names. So really, from as long as I can remember, I've been fascinated with racehorses.
Do you still have those scrapbooks?
I do.
Do you ever go back and look at them and just say, wow, man, I was hooked on this game from the early stages?
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. I think I'm a very, very fortunate person. You know, I've always sort of known that horses were going to be my life. I didn't really know I would train horses. But, you know, I look back and I say, well, I've always been pointed in this direction.
You know, Michelle Nihe talked about sitting in her bedroom at night and she would be reading the daily racing form and all that, kind of with the flashlight underneath the cover so she wouldn't get caught by her parents. Were you kind of in that, cut from that same mold?
I wouldn't say that. I wouldn't say I really got seriously studying racing until I came on the track. You know, this was more of a, you know, a fun thing for me when I was young.
Did you have any horse encounters along the way? I mean, were you able to ride a horse here or there or do anything with horses?
You know, I was probably 11 or 12, and I finally persuaded my parents to let me take riding lessons. So, you know, I was a city girl, but I did get to go every Saturday and ride. So, that I had always wanted to be around horses in some manner. So that was great. And didn't really know what direction I'd go, but I knew my career would be in horses. I was sort of headed towards the college program, the equine program, from the time I was in grade school. That was my aim.
Us city folk, that's about one of the only places that we ever get to see horses is at the racetrack. Nick Zito talked about that last week, being a New Yorker, and I'm from LA, and you know, when you're in the city, there's really no place to be around horses. Like if you live in Kentucky or Virginia or someplace where horses are more of a normal way of life.
No, there really isn't. I remember I used to have to take, you know, 2 transit buses and walk through a park to get to the riding stables to ride. But then one winter, my father took me actually to Hialeah to the races when we were in Florida, and that was such a beautiful place at that time, and I think that really cemented I wanted to be around that.
Well, and then, of course, you went to school for equine studies, and I know as part of those programs that you actually had to serve 2-week internships in different equine-related businesses. That had to go a long way toward helping you in your career decision.
Well, absolutely. I mean, I came to the racetrack for my 2 weeks, and I never left. I started working here before school and then heading to school. You know, of course, racetrack starts early, so I could be here at 5 and still make school by 8 and have done half a day's work.
Talking with trainer Josie Carroll on Trainer Talk, presented by Fazer Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. So what was your very first job on the racetrack, Josie?
I came on field placement, and they let me walk horses and groom a little bit, did a little bit of everything. And then my first job that they actually paid me for was grooming.
Who was the trainer that you started with?
That was a trainer called Sam Dixon, and I worked for him for a few months, and then was fortunate enough to get a job with Mac Benson, who was training for Winfield's Farm at the time.
Winfield's one of the all-time great farms and a fantastic place to raise a horse. I mean, they had tremendous success, so that had to give you a good start.
You know, it was great, and there was a lot of name recognition of the horses and the pedigrees because they were always in the papers in that time. And, you know, Mr. E.P. Taylor was alive at that time. I was fortunate enough to meet him. It was really a great experience.
You know, and it has to be very rewarding considering where you are today. I mentioned those 600-plus career winners, but knowing that you did this from the ground up and you did it, you know, as a grassroots type of effort, putting in the hard work to get to this level, I would imagine, Josie, that has to be extremely rewarding for you when you look back on where you came from in this business.
It is, absolutely. And it also helps me a lot. You know, you see so much coming up under, you know, I came up under some really good people, and you really do learn a lot. And when situations come up, there's, you know, many a time you look back to years ago and say, oh, I remember what somebody did in that situation or what the solution to that problem was.
Talk about some of those people that you had the opportunity to work with and some of the things that you've taken away from them that you still incorporate today.
Probably the first trainer to light a fire under me was John Tamaro Sr. Mm-hmm. John was training for Kinghaven at the time, and I went to work for him grooming. It was my second year on the track. I was grooming for him over the winter on Kinghaven's farm in Ocala, and he said to me, why don't you run one of these training barns? And my response was, I don't know anything. I don't know enough to do that. He said, you know, you're going to groom your whole life? Just get in there and do it. You know, it kind of really gave me a push.
Yeah, he threw you in the deep end of the pool on the first day. But that sometimes that's good. And there's nothing, I think, better for trainers than the learn by doing method. I mean, until you're doing it, you know, you can study, you can listen, you can follow some great horsemen around. But when you're actually doing it and you see a lot of pitfalls and you have to come up with solutions, as you mentioned, that's where it's at, really.
And I think his strength as a mentor, you know, I would say, you know, I would call him and say, well, what am I going to do? And he'd say, well, tell me, what are you going to do? You know, he forced you to think, but was there for you know, to fall back on. You knew you weren't going to screw anything up too badly.
And, of course, after John Tamaro Sr., there was a stint with Hall of Famer Roger Atfield, if I'm not mistaken.
I worked for him one winter. Just, you know, was fortunate enough. I needed something to do over a winter, and I worked for Roger. And, you know, again, you get to see one of the greats of our day. You know, he's a tremendous trainer with a very interesting background. You know, he's got a great reputation for training good horses and route horses and grass horses. And, you know, you saw something different there. I think you take something away from everybody you work for if you pay attention.
Well, he's such a charming guy and a very interesting man to talk to. And you're right. I mean, but when you look at the people that you've worked for, it's like the who's who of Canadian racing, really.
You know, and all of them have helped me and taught me along the way. I've been so fortunate with these people that have, you know, sort of given of their experience and their time. And when I eventually went out on my own, I had been working for Mike Doyle for quite a few years, and Mike went to take a private job with Mr. Stronach as a racing manager, and some of his clients said they would stay with me, which was fabulous. I think I had about 20 horses to start out with, which nobody gets that opportunity, and some nice horses. But of course, then I started to learn the business end of it. I didn't have any money, and I had people working for me. How was I going to pay all these people? You know, and again, you know, Mike stepped in. He took me down to meet his business manager at the bank, and they gave me a line of credit based on the receivables because they were his receivables and they knew the people were good. And, you know, you learn a whole different aspect. It's not just horses. You have to keep yourself afloat as well.
Yeah, that's always a struggle for many trainers. And that's one thing that I always tell people that ask me, you know, would you be a trainer again, or what advice would you give me? I want to be a trainer. And I always tell them, you've got to learn the business end, because the horses, you know, are great, but if you ignore the business, you're not going to be in business very long. And it's a very, very difficult life for a lot of trainers. And that was an important lesson, I'm sure.
That was, when I look back, it was a really big leg up, because I simply wouldn't have had the funds to get out with that many horses. You know, you have to pay people right away. That starts right away before you start getting money in, you know?
Josie, what year was it that you finally decided to go out on your own?
That was 94, the end of 94.
And you've been based at Woodbine pretty much ever since. You're now a perennial leading trainer at Woodbine. That has to make you feel pretty special doing that in your hometown of Canada, or Toronto, I should say.
Yeah, and pretty lucky, you know. I mean, you're only as good as the horses you train, and I've had some great clients, you know, that trusted me with their horses from very early on. You know, I think the Eaton family that Mike trained for, I mean, they gave me stake horses to train from the beginning, and, you know, I had a horse for them called Tethra, who was my first stake winner, and of course, you know, he won three stakes in a row, and it puts you on the map. You can win as many races as you want, but you don't get that recognition until you have those good horses.
Yeah, you come a long way since Lilac Charm in 1994.
Lilac Charm was my first, yes, for Mr. Stronach.
Yeah, what do you remember about that day? That had to be just emotional and exciting at the same time.
You know, it was, truthfully, it was a relief, because I had, you know, I had taken over, you know, a ton of horses. We had just broken up. I remember clearly breaking a bunch of their maidens just before I took them over. So we had gone through a lot of conditions, and I think I went like 29 horses without a win, and I was like panicking. So as exciting as it was like a relief, like, thank God I got the monkey off my back, you know?
Yeah, that's always a lot of pressure when you start out and you want to do well, and you should have just waited and broke those maidens when they were running in your name.
I know, exactly. You know, you look back and you try to think of, what was I doing wrong? And I said, well, I really wasn't doing anything wrong. Just, you know, we had done a lot leading into me taking those horses over. And you know, and of course there were mistakes made along the way too. We all learn by experience, but it was, instead of being as exciting as it should have been, I think it was just like, whew, thank God.
Yeah. Sometimes the wins feel like that. They feel like a big relief. You've had some fantastic clients, and you know, starting out with stake horses, I think is a great thing, because those are the ones that get you the recognition, that get you more stakes horses. And a lot of times when you're, you know, kicking around claiming horses and doing whatever, you can win a bunch of races, but the big owners, the ones that can really make a difference in your life, they don't pay attention to that as much as they do seeing your picture on the cover of the form, or reading an article about you, or seeing you on television or whatever.
No, absolutely. I think those people, they want to see that when you get a good horse in your hands, you know what to do with it. And in order to get those horses in your hands, you've got to have the opportunity. And some people just don't get those breaks.
Josie, every trainer goes through, I'll call it a slump, where they have a streak and things aren't going 100% according to plan. You mentioned that winless streak before Lilac Charm came along, and the relief that you felt with that victory. How difficult is it to not second guess yourself and the way you're doing things when you go through a streak like that?
It's, you know, really hard and really frustrating. You know, we all go through some tough periods, and you just have to keep looking back at what you've done and how well it has stood you. I mean, you might look at smaller things to tweak, but you've just got to stick with your basics that have worked for you.
Well, you take out your trainer's license, you get your first winner in 1994, you wait 15 years for your first open grade one winner when Careless Jewel comes along. Was there pressure trying to achieve that goal and get that trophy on your mantle as well?
You know, you dream of that, winning a grade one. I mean, that's something you really aspire to. You know, fortunately in between I had my Queen's Plate winner here, which was huge in Canada. So, you know, I kind of had a stepping stone on the way to that grade one.
You know, people see trainers like yourself and Todd Pletcher and people that compete at the highest level of this game, and they see you now competing on the big stage consistently. But how difficult is it to get a horse of that caliber and to keep that horse at that particular grade one, grade two type of level?
Well, I think that, you know, the toughest thing there is what you're competing against, and there's often very little separating a field of good horses, and you've got to constantly be looking for that edge, or what you can do better, or where to improve, because the margins are so small in those kind of races. I think that's, you've always got to keep that in your mind, that what you're running against is going to be very competitive, and you've always got to be looking forward. You can never be complacent with where you are.
I think one of the things that I've been impressed with most about your horses is that you can train almost any kind of horse with equal success, whether it's a sprinter, a two-year-old, a distance turf horse, a horse on the poly, or a horse on the dirt. I mean, some trainers, you know, we talked about Atfield, he's the turf trainer, blah, blah, blah. It's not that he couldn't train other horses, but it's probably a function of his barn. But it seems like no matter what type of horse you get, you seem to get the best out of it. Is there a key there?
I don't know. I guess, you know, I get a whole lot of different horses in the barn, and I try to have a very individual program. We try to really key our training, our feed, everything towards the individual, and really think about them one at a time and not group horses together, and I'm sure that helps.
Talking with trainer Josie Carroll on Trainer Talk presented by Fazit Tipton here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Josie, I mentioned the name Careless Jewel, and she was certainly spectacular. Look back on that day in 2009 when she cruised to that 11-length victory in the Alabama Stakes at Saratoga.
It's just a blur. It was unbelievable. It was such an exciting moment to be at Saratoga, and the roar of the crowd. I mean, it's really unforgettable. Especially after she started the day by dropping her rider twice.
Yeah, what goes, you know, through that, your mind at that point?
That moment when I had my binoculars on, she's behind the gate and there's no rider on her, and I was just just dying, you know?
Oh, I can imagine that has to be excruciating considering all the work and time that you put into getting her to that starting gate and then to have that happen.
I mean, thank God Robert Landry hung on to her, you know, when she got up to her antics. She was just the kind of horse, you know, she was a terrible handful in post-parade and warm-up. But the moment she stepped foot in that starting gate, everything settled, her ears went forward. She just focused, you know. She was really quite unique.
Yeah, sometimes those fillies can be a little bit tough and a little unpredictable. But she had so much talent and could really overcome a lot.
It was just pure fun, you know. I mean, as tough as this game is, when you have days like that, you've got to enjoy them. And that's what it was. It was fun.
Josie, so many trainers that appear on this show credit their owners that they've been associated with over the years for a lot of their success. So talk about some of the people you've had the opportunity to be involved with on the owner side of things.
Well, absolutely. As I said, you're only as good as the horses in your barn. And certainly it started with the Eaton family giving me a chance. And then the Sapera family sort of came into our barn, Jim and Alice Sapera, and they really took me to a different level. We went to sales. I really hadn't done a whole lot of buying. You know, they took me to the sales and trusted my judgment. They were spending $1 million or $2 million at the sales and giving me those kind of horses. I mean, that's such an opportunity. When those horses started doing well, John Secura of Hillendale, Eugene Melnick, they stepped in. The Donver people that owned Careless Jewel and, of course, Inglorious, who won the Queen's Plate and the Canadian Oaks, they came because Mr. Sapera was also from out west. So it all sort of flowed, you know?
Yeah, the Queen's Plate, basically the crown jewel, for lack of a better term, of Canadian racing. Talk about that experience and how important it is as a Canadian to win that race.
You know, when I won it with Edenwald, who was the first of my two, I mean, I'll never forget that day. It was surreal. You know, that's what you dreamed of since you were young. I mean, the Queen's Plate's always been the aspiration, you know, of anybody in Canada. And that day was overwhelming. I mean, it was crossing the wire in front was great. But I'll tell you, the moment that, you know, it still almost brings tears to my eyes. It sounds kind of corny. When the horse walked back in front of the crowd and the cheer went up and it was pure love of sport. There was nothing about, you know, gaming or gambling, or it was just pure love of the animal and the sport and the appreciation from the crowd. I think I'll never, ever forget that moment. I think that was the sort of the purest moment I've ever had in the sport.
Yeah, well said. Josie Carroll joining us on Trainer Talk, presented by Fayzid Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Josie, you obviously are based at Woodbine, but you have stables all over the United States now in various parts of the country. How did that decision come about to expand and to start stabling horses at other tracks? And was it more out of necessity with the owners that you were able to associate yourself with?
Really, I'm only away in the winter. I'm pretty much at Woodbine, and then it's winter racing where I do more traveling. If we're running at other tracks, I'm more inclined to ship and run.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, we want to winter race a lot of, you know, when you do have nice horses and allowance horses, you can't really put them up for the winter the way you do some of the claiming horses up north here. You're developing a horse and you need somewhere to go. So it started with going to Florida, and that worked out well. And then Mr. Sapera asked me to take some of his to New Orleans. We had some really, really successful meets there, and that led to me splitting the stable over the winter.
So you have one division in Louisiana and one division in Florida during the winter?
Usually so, yeah.
And then an occasional visit to Keeneland because we see your ponytail around Keeneland every once in a while.
Yeah, I do. Well, again, it sort of works. It works well. You know, you sort of you leave the south and you're working your way north. So spring meet at Keeneland is always a wonderful meet, and racing in Canada is just getting underway. Most of it is, you know, 5 furlongs, short races for the first couple of weeks. You know, and that really isn't my forte. And most of those horses have been winter raced, so you don't really want to shorten them up. So it's just sort of a natural progression.
Josie, I know you're also very big on your team and the people that work with you. You had a quote that I had read where it said that many owners come to the barn and they see the same people year after year taking care of their horses, and that's something that you take a lot of pride in, and that's very important to you.
It's very important to me. I'll tell you, you can't top the crew of people I have. And most of them, some of them have been with me from the very beginning, which is really amazing on the racetrack. You know, I think if you're going to be successful, you have to surround yourself with the very best people you can and listen to them and learn off them. You know, these people have been around a long time just because they chose not to do something different. They chose to stay grooming horses or riding horses or even walking horses. Many of them have seen a lot and have great input. And you just have to listen to these people, and it does so much for your outfit. I mean, they're the backbone. They really are.
I think that's something that a lot of trainers miss sometimes is listening to their employees more frequently. You come across people as you're training horses that really have some good insights into the animals and maybe have a better way of doing it than you would think of. And if you're too hard-headed, you don't take advantage of those things.
No, I think you're right there. And just the very subtle things, you know, you'll have a hot walker tell you this horse was coughing when I walked it. And you know that they know their job, and that they're not just, the horse didn't just grab a bite of hay because they know the difference. You know, you have to appreciate what they have to offer you and check something like that out. You might be headed to a race and this horse might be full of mucus. And if you don't check it out or listen to these people, it costs you, and every race counts, right?
Well, Josie, believe it or not, just a couple of minutes left to wrap up this edition of Trainer Talk. We've really enjoyed hearing your story. And when we do have time, we always like to ask trainers what other hobbies that they have and what things they like to do in those very rare moments when they're not at the racetrack. So what does Josie Carroll like to do when she's not at the racetrack?
You know, there's very little time when I'm not doing something related to this. You know, I'll relax with a book or something in the evening, but that's really all I do outside of here. Pedal around in my garden a little bit to decompress sometimes when it's been a really stressful day and you just need to wind down a little bit. But that's about it.
Well, that's a nice pastime, being outside. Horse trainers always seem to like to be outside.
I guess we do.
Well, Josie, we can't thank you enough for being here tonight on Trainer Talk presented by Phasic Tipton. All of our guests who appear on the program receive gifts from our sponsors, EPO Equine and Flair Equine Nasal Strips. So we will get those out to you. And again, thank you so much. Really enjoyed hearing your story.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
All right, Josie Carroll, wrapping up this Trainer Talk show presented by Phasic Tipton. And Jude, two outstanding guests on the program here tonight. Michelle Nihay kicking things off in the first half, and then Josie here in the second half of the show. If our listeners missed any of this particular program, you can go back to our website, listen to a podcast at your leisure. That's all at horseracingradio.net and Horse Racing Radio Network on iTunes. But wow, again, we just sit here and just are in awe at the stories that we hear from our trainers.
Yes, even if we do say so ourselves.
No. You know what I'm saying. It has nothing to do with you and I.
No.
I
hate to even ask a question or anything. I just let them go.
Yeah, stay out of their way.
Yeah, they're just really fascinating. And it's so much fun to do these shows. I mean, it's really, really entertaining and for us, and hopefully for the listeners as well.
And don't forget, we are back tomorrow afternoon. Ellis Starr, Sean Feld, Chad Summers will be with you from 3 to 6 Eastern Time with our HRN live coverage, taking you through racing from Saratoga and from Del Mar on a Thursday afternoon. This particular show from 6 to 7 will be the Bristnet.com call-in show. And then on Friday, we're here, Chad, Sean, and Ellis from 3 to 6. And then we return with the Express Bet Weekend Stakes Preview from 6 to 7. You can see that entire schedule on our site, horseracingradio.net. And don't forget, it's Arlington Million Week. We make our way back to the Windy City this weekend for all of our shows on Saturday.
Can't wait. Arlington Million Weekend and the festival. It's going to be fantastic.
All right, check out the schedule, horseracingradio.net. For our producer, Lee Delapina, Jude Feld, the pontiff of the Pick Four, I'm Mike Penna. We'll talk to you next time on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
Good night, Barbados.